I'm here to share our story of Agape International Missions. And this scripture that I have on the screen really tells what it is we're trying to do and what we feel that God wants us to do in His name. It says, "You hear, O Lord, the desire of the afflicted. You encourage them. You listen to their cry, defending the fatherless and the oppressed, in order that man who is of the earth may terrify no more." That is what God does, and He calls us to be a part of it. So I'm going to review just real quick. Most of you, if you've been to the main sessions, have got a good understanding and a grasp on that we have a huge problem in our world. But it is the fastest growing illegal trade in the world today. A wide range of estimates exist on the scope and magnitude of modern-day slavery. The International Labor Organization, the United Nations agency charged with addressing labor standards, employment, and social protection issues, estimates that there are 12.3 million people in forced labor, bonded labor, forced child labor, sexual servitude at any given time. Other estimates range from 4 million to 27 million. And that comes directly from the U.S. State Department's Trafficking in Persons report that was issued last June. That's an annual report that we do, and so that we can try to keep current. But it's really a difficult thing to put a specific number on. The 27 million number comes from a study that National Geographic did. And there are more people today locked in literal slavery in our world than were extracted from Africa during the 400 years of the transatlantic slave trade combined. That's something that just boggled my mind, because we all have accepted that was a horrible time in our country's history, in the world's history, and we thought slavery was abolished, but it truly is not. 79% of these crimes are concentrated on sexual exploitation, and much of that is very violent. In Southeast Asia and parts of Africa, minors make up the majority of the sex slave. What I want to do to introduce human trafficking in Cambodia to you is actually show you about 5 minutes of an undercover video that is in a village called Sfeipok. Pay attention to the buildings, because this is devastating, but there's hope coming.
In a country famed for its lack of law enforcement, this is a strange sight indeed. Police in Phnom Penh heading out on a raid. This is no ordinary operation. Their target is an industry that's more used to official protection than policing. For years, the brothels of Cambodia have been operating without fear of interference. They've redefined the limits of the world's oldest profession, openly recruiting the very young for a clientele with an insatiable appetite for children.
The local men believe that having sex with virgins, with young children, boost up their sexual appetite, their strength, their integrity.
Foreign pedophiles have also developed a taste for Cambodia's children. Though they hide their faces today, they've made the country one of the world's top destinations for sex tourism. And a broken society, struggling for survival, desperate for money, stands idly by while its young are sold for sex. We're driving through the outskirts of Phnom Penh on our way to Sfeipok, 11 kilometres up the road. It's the most notorious brothel district in Cambodia, where Cambodian men go when they're looking for sex with the very young. It's also a popular destination with foreign pedophiles.
What's that?
Looking very young girl.
This squalid shantytown is no place for the ordinary tourist. Just those who come to pay for sex, met by those who want to sell. Just how young would be revealed within minutes inside one of Fay Pak's many shopfront brothels. First to be paraded is a girl who claims to be 14 but looks younger.
Oh my God.
Next, a 10-year-old, clearly frightened and confused as her innocence is bargained away. Yum yum in the vernacular of Cambodia's sex trade is oral sex. The children repeat these words like a mantra.
What?
She has done that before.
A few minutes later, yet another 10-year-old called in from the street to offer herself up. Although she's tiny, the pimp assures me she understands what is expected, and for $10 will perform oral sex. In Fay Pak, it's a trade from morning to night. Tonight the children are already waiting. They swarm forward, competing with each other to offer themselves up.
Ten years? No, ten. Eleven years.
The children squabble over who will go with the foreigner. This is an adult game. Money is the prize. Eventually, we make an excuse and leave alone.
It's pretty sobering, pretty shocking, you know, what when you really have a chance to see how little these girls are and what happens to them. Cambodia is a country that, when I heard this, I knew it was Southeast Asia, but I didn't study my geography well enough to remember exactly where it was. And if you will look on the map, you'll see the red, how it has a little fishtail down at the bottom. That little pink country there, that's Cambodia. Thailand is just north of it, and Vietnam surrounds it on its east coast. And this country has experienced just a horrific, violent past in recent history. But estimates say that there are somewhere between 4,000 and 30,000 children, underage girls, that are sold as sex slaves and in exploitation every year in Cambodia. UNICEF is the one who came up with the 30,000 figure. But it's just really hard to know because it's such an undercover operation. You don't get people voluntarily telling you. Sorry, excuse me, just a minute. I forgot I'm supposed to be talking into this even though you can't hear me. So that's where we are. And you know, you ask ourselves, I've asked myself, how could a country become so mired in such unspeakable acts? And you have to go back to its recent history. So I want to give you a short history lesson on Cambodia. From in the late 70s, from 1975 to 1979, there was a horrible man named Pol Pot. and he had an army called the Khmer Rouge, and they began a mass genocide of their country's government, military, religious leaders, the educated and the wealthy, and their families. He wanted an equal society where everyone was all the same, and the educated, the influential, they were seen as the enemy, and they systematically began driving them out of the cities. Within 4 days after he won victory, he drove people completely out of Phnom Penh and just began an awful reign of terror for 4 years. Estimates range that from 1,200,000 to 1,007,000 people were killed by Pol Pot. Some estimates say that even maybe up to 3 million people died as related disease and starvation. The photo that you see before you is a monument from one of the killing fields. What they would do is they would just round people up, drive them out to a field, have them dig their own hole, then they would hit them on the head with hammers and they would fall in, then they would slit their throats, then they would cover them up. And you've got over 300 of these fields where there are just numerous, numerous graves. This is a killing field not far from Phnom Penh that was the killing field for their notorious prison called S21. And this is a monument, and it is filled with the skulls of the people that they have begun to recover their bodies. Today, that prison, not today, this is what it looked like in January of 1979 when it was still in use. And shortly after Vietnam came in and conquered the country and removed Pol Pot from power. But I want to give you just a little bit, this gets pretty graphic, and if you have any problems with this, please don't feel that you will offend me by getting up and walking out. It's pretty hard to hear some of this information. But Tuol Sleng was a prison where they had very severe regulations. It was a prison where you were brought for one reason, and that was to get you to confess to being a traitor against the revolution. And as soon as you confessed, then you were killed. You couldn't win. And, you know, many people would confess because of the torture, even though they had done nothing wrong. Some people would try to kill themselves because they didn't want to go through the torturous process. But I just highlighted one of these regulations. It's called, while getting lashes or electrification, you must not cry out at all. And if you did, this sign right next to it, that was there, it is there today, but right next to it was this big pit, and it would be full of urine, and they would hang you upside down and put you in it till you almost drowned if you cried when they were electrocuting you. These people suffered horribly as a whole country. And so they suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. They were tortured. This is something that you might can relate to today. This is a piece of equipment used for waterboarding. And this is what it looked like. This is a rendition by an artist that the prisoners kept alive because they wanted him to record the things that were happening. So he drew this picture on the bottom of how they would tie people up and just pour water over them till the point of them almost drowning. This is a lady. If you're actually there, you can see with the photo reproduction, it's hard to tell. She was crying. She was crying because as soon as her photo was taken, her baby would be removed from her and probably taken out and hit on a tree until it died. And then she would systematically be tortured until she confessed to having committed crimes and then be killed. This is what you see at the killing fields today. If you walk around and what you see, those things that look like white sticks, they're human bones. They have now begun, after these 30 years, to work their way up through the ground. These are the clothes, same thing, of these people's bodies. And as you walk around, it's a very sobering thing. But you will find these pits. They're like potholes in the area where all these bones are now beginning to be exposed. And it's just, you know, I lack for the words to describe what a horrific, horrific place and experience that this country has been through. But when you understand that, you begin to understand how it could be such an open door to the evil that has taken root in it. This created people that they had a very large void in people capable of leading the country. The people that were doing this killing were 10 to 17 year olds. Those are the people that are leading this country today. They've seared their conscience. They don't have one. And then it's driven the country into abject poverty. And so out of this, you have this desperation of a people. In their conflict, once Vietnam came in, they did remove Pol Pot from power. He fled to Thailand. They were there for 10 years, and then they decided to withdraw. During that 10-year period, they opened the border and allowed Vietnamese people to come in and settle into Cambodia. When they decided to withdraw, they closed the border, would not allow their own people to return, and Cambodia refuses to recognize those people as its own citizens. So now you have villages of people within the country who are in these horrible conditions, and they are not even seen as citizens, so they're not helped by the government in any way, shape, or form. And that is where you have the development of this sex trade, and especially in this village in Phnom Penh area called Svepak. This country was left decimated and emaciated by Pol Pot. This is what the country looks like today around Phnom Penh. In Phnom Penh itself, on the major streets, you have a little bit more modern buildings, but these are all villages within a few miles, and some actually within this, that's a photo of their river where they've got houses built over it where all their sewage drains right into it and drains out into the main rivers, into the Mekong. This is a squatter's village that you see on the bottom. These people were removed from their homes. They were simply rounded up at gunpoint and taken out and dropped off and said, "We want your property now." The Khmer Rouge had destroyed all records of property ownership, so even though property had been in families for generations, it's been lost. And so they have to build with whatever they can get their hands on. These are some little children that you see in the streets, and actually some girls from our aftercare center took these two photos. We have an exhibit of those photos, and that's another story we can share at another time. But they gave a title to it, and this one little girl standing alone, is the title of that photograph is, "I want to help her, but I've nothing to give." The other title is called Pity House. These girls are very, very concerned that these children will too be pushed into the sex trafficking industry. So how do you respond to something so devastating? And it comes with responding with the unconditional love of Jesus Christ. In 1989, Agape International Missions, or as we like to say for short, AIM, was founded by Moses and Samantha Seth. Moses is a Cambodian who managed to escape the Khmer Rouge, get to a refugee camp, get to the United States. He became educated here. He is a Christian man. He was very influential in his country, and at one time was a lieutenant in Lon Nol's army. And he is just a wonderful, wonderful man. He has some wonderful stories about, even though I am a lieutenant, I never kill. I will not kill anyone. But he's very respected in his country, and he went back and began to share the gospel with people and began to establish churches. It's our mission now to prevent child sex trafficking and restore hope to its victims by providing holistic aftercare to those victims who are fortunate enough to be rescued, by equipping and mobilizing the church to take action, and by opening community centers in sex trafficking hotspots. It's not enough just to provide aftercare, because we could do that and the problem would never go away. We've got to take action. We've got to get the church and anyone else involved that will become involved to begin to prevent this. Agape Restoration Center opened in 2006. We switched the focus of the ministry to ending this sex trafficking in 2005. A pastor from the Rockland area here in California, a large church, about 6,000 people, and his wife had gone to visit Moses. And when they came home, they saw the Dateline special of the Svepak situation, and they knew they had to respond and do something. That was my boss, and I was working with him on the project, and God said, "I want you to do something too." So as they began to get this project ready, my husband and I visited. We also decided that God was not necessarily calling us to move there, but we were working through to see what it was he had called us to do. I ended up going and spending almost 3 months there, helping to prepare to open the aftercare center, working in program development, and then going back also to help get our community centers established. But what we do with these girls at Agape Restoration Center is provide a holistic approach, a wonderful program. It starts out by meeting their physical needs. Most of these girls haven't even had one meal a day when we get them, unless they have come from another care center. But we start with meeting those basic needs of life so that we can begin to earn their trust. Their behavior's feral when they come. They'll kick, scream, bite, hit. We don't allow any of that to ever be returned, simply to be responded to with love. And it takes about 6 to 12 weeks, depending on the severity of the girl's abuse. And all of a sudden, it's almost every time, it's like a light switch. The behavior changes. The walls begin to come down. They know that they are loved. They know that they're going to be fed. They begin to have hope that things can be different. We have a psychosocial program, or it's called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. Big word. It's a step program. It was based on a 12-step program for traumatized children here in the United States, and the psychologist who established it came to the country, and we worked and created a modified form for the culture there. But it takes the girls from the point that they begin to trust us and leads them to the place where they can share their trauma in detail. And until they get it out, we don't believe that there can be true healing, because they still accept the fact that they're no good, they're trash, that's what their culture tells them, even though they culture did this to them. And so when they have the opportunity to get this out, they can begin to believe there's good things about them themselves. And like I said, we share the love of Jesus Christ with them, and many of them accept him as their personal savior as well. We take care of their educational needs. Most of the cases that we get, the girls come, are involved with court trials, so there's a need for high security. We have a very secure facility there, and so we have a school on site. We have a memorandum of understanding with the Education Department of Cambodia, and we have credentialed teachers, and these girls can earn their high school diplomas right there on site at the Restoration Center. We also train them vocationally, and most of them love to go into either tailoring or cosmetology, but we also offer some others. We offer IT, international cuisine, tourism. We have partnerships with businesses all through Phnom Penh so that these girls can really develop into the person that God created them to be and develop their unique gifts. Their spiritual needs, we just love them with the unconditional love of Christ. They are have opportunity to attend devotions and mornings. That's not a requirement by any means, because we are going to love each girl the same unconditionally for who she is as an individual. So, but they do have that opportunity, and like I say, most of them end up at some point accepting Christ into their life as their Savior. I want to tell you just a few stories. These first few are okay, not too difficult to hear, and then I'm going to get into sharing some that are very graphic. So again, if you would prefer to not hear that, I won't be offended at all if you want to get up and leave. This is a little girl. Her name's Dina. We actually got her just before she was trafficked. And how do we know this? As we began to talk with her, her mother had been training her what to do using her brother as a model. She's 5, and she was just getting ready to sell her to the brothels. We happened to have another aftercare facility who saw and recognized some of the things that were going on from the outside and got permission to just take her. And so we still got legal custody of her. But we were able to ultimately get her back with a grandmother, a family member, that we felt very safe in. And when we reintegrate, we follow up for 3 years. We don't just send someone back out into society. Our counselors and social workers continue to work with the girls for a minimum of 3 years, and we'll work with them longer if we really feel it's necessary. This is another young lady who was rescued found out she was the daughter of a pastor who there had been a lot of family discord, and she chose to run away and got caught up in all of this horrible things. She was bleeding profusely from her third forced abortion, and she would have died within 24 hours had we not gotten hold of her. She came, we got her medical care, she's now doing very well, and we're working on the restoration with the family. This is Mian. I have a story I'm going to read of Mian's. She was a little bit older and has just a little bit different story. Mian is the oldest child in her family, and she felt the burden of her family's survival was hers to bear. She lived with her family in a Vietnamese community named Svepok, just outside the capital city of Phnom Penh. Svepok was and still is infamous for the sexual trafficking of girls, some as young as 5 years old. Her family was living in abject poverty. I saw the terrible situation of my family and I could not understand it. We were so poor. Every day, creditors would knock on our door and ask my mother to pay back the loans she had taken to support our family. But we had no money. My father was an alcoholic. He beat my mother and neglected my younger brothers. He drank our family into debt. I could not stand to watch my mother cry anymore. I decided to sell myself. It was a hard decision. I was 14 at the time. She was held captive in a small wooden house across the street from the brothel in Svepok. When I first went to the brothel, I felt scared. The brothel owner waited until he could find a foreign man who would pay a high price for me, especially since I was a virgin. When they found a foreigner to pay a high price, they settled me in the small pink room, the virgin room, located on the second floor. This room was reserved for the rape and torture of the young innocents. After her virginity and innocence were brutally stolen from her, her value became less and less with each purchase of her body. Her body was used as brutally as the buyer pleased. As this violence was heaped upon her, Mian would wonder, how could such an unthinkable, unspeakable things be happening to me? She was raped and sexually tortured from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. for 6 months. And from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m., she was locked in the wooden structure across the street. After she had been there 6 months, a raid led by International Justice Mission was conducted on the brothel to rescue the children held there. Believing the lies of the brothel owner regarding the anti-trafficking police, she hid and was not rescued. She believed it was too dangerous and risky to stay in Svepok, so she migrated to the brothel in Siem Reap over the next 3 years. She felt she had such great despair, she was made to feel like an animal, lowly, and with absolutely no value. She became hopeless. I felt bored with life. I felt I didn't want to do this anymore. But what else could I do? I didn't have a skill, and my family depended on the money I sent to them. Shanti. I'll show you Shanti's photo later. Heroic. It's a good word to describe Shanti. Shanti was one of the victims of an American pedophile, Michael Pepe. Living in the country of Cambodia, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Special Agent Robert Schock said, "The details of this case are as appalling as any we have ever encountered in a sex tourism investigation." To make matters worse, after Pepe was through raping and torturing Shanti, he passed her on to another American pedophile living in Cambodia. He continued the terrible abuse of this innocent young girl. In part, Shanti's heroism is seen in the testimony she presented at the trial of Michael Pepe. That was last year, last May. She and 5 other girls came to the States to testify. There she relived her trauma in order to protect other girls from experiencing her pain. Pepe was found guilty on all 7 charges brought against him. Here are her words and some of her story. "When I was 13 years old, I live in Michael Pepe's house near Norming Market, near the ARC office, with 4 other girls, a cook, a security person, and Michael Pepe. I went to live there because Miss Sang, my neighbor, called me to live there to work as a cleaner. I want to help my family working as a cleaner. When I arrived at Michael's house, I feel upset scared, afraid, and lonely because all the other girls can go out except for me. I live in Michael's house only 1 month. In first 2 weeks I lived there, I was scared, afraid, and worked as a cleaner. Then Michael raped me when no one was in the house. Michael called me in his room, tied me down, and raped me. He hit me when I call out loudly for others to help me because a security person was outside the door, but he hit me more. He put a sock in my mouth, and then he would rape me, and it hurt me very much. I hate myself. I'm angry, shy, and regretful. I feel I have no value. I feel like I am in a jail, and I feel I'm very afraid of him. After that day, he forced me to watch sex movies. Then he would tie me up and rape me. He always did that every time he raped me. He would do like they do in the sex movies, and he watches them and forced me to watch and do the same. And I have one more story I want to share that gets even a little more graphic. This young lady suffered incredibly. Her name is Soka. This is the story of my trauma. I lived in Michael's house about 4 months. When I first saw his house, I really want to stay there because it is a nice, beautiful, very big house. I go there at first, did not do bad things to me. I only clean the house and do some work around the house. 2 or 3 days later, they called me to see Michael's room and to see him there, and I have to massage Michael every day for about 2 weeks. During those 2 weeks, I massage him and I suck him, and there were 3 people in the room. We 3 were undressed. After that 2 weeks, Michael raped me. And the first time, it wasn't too bad, too deep, but there were 4 people in the room. They tied her legs and her hands because she moved too much. They told her not to move, but she still moved and screamed very, very loudly because of the pain. When I saw that they did bad to Hing like that, I feel much pity for her and afraid they will tie me and do that to me again. So I did not scream or move with Michael when he raped me the first time. At that time, he put it in and I not feel too much pain. He did that to me with Hang for about 2 weeks. Hang's father knows what is happening to her too and is angry because they tied his daughter. I don't want to leave that house because it's a nice house. Everything's good. There was good food. There was ball. There was bicycle. There was fish. The only bad things was they forced me to have sex. When he raped me the first time, there was no blood. Then he raped me again, and it really hurt me this time, and there was much blood. I was in much pain, and I scream and move, and he held my hand, and the lady held my legs to not move. Then they tell me not to scream. I still did, and so they put scarf in my mouth. 1 more week, Sang told me to go downstairs with her and Michael to watch a sex movie and be all undressed. While watching the movie, Sang gave me a tablet to swallow. After I swallow, I feel like I want to have sex. At that time, I don't know what it did to me. The next day, he called me to see me in his room again for a massage. Every time I stay in the room, Sang is always with me and teach me how to do everything. When he raped me, there would be much blood, but not as much as the first time, but it still hurt me very bad. I felt so tired, I slept in this room until morning. Then I go to the bathroom, and I lost consciousness there. Sang's husband took me to the doctor. My mother and Sang and her husband go to stay with me. Doctor checks me and gives me some tablets to take. When I came back from the hospital at night, he asked me to massage him again, but he did not rape me. I did that 1 week. Then he started to rape me again. 2-3 days later, he raped me very bad until the blood came out. I cried very hard because it's too painful. The next day at Tsang's, Tsang's husband took me to see a different doctor. My mother, Tsang, and her husband went with me. The doctor checked me and gave me an injection. I don't know what medicine they gave me. They also gave me some tablets. I came back to his house to rest for 3 or 4 days, and he called me to massage him again. I don't remember when. Michael went to USA, but Tsang translated for me. Michael goes to have a party. I stay in that house alone at night for 2 days, and I'm so afraid. Tsang came to see me only 1 day. Michael came back from USA only 1 day, then he start raping me again. On that day, Tsang was not there. He raped me and it hurt me so very much. I can't bear it. I want to go home. When he finished, he told me to go back to my room. The next night, he did it again and did that every day. Some nights there was blood, some nights no. One night, I don't remember, I bleed so much. In the morning, Tsang's husband took me to see a different doctor. I stayed in the hospital for a week. My family visit me and stay there with me. Doctor put serum in me, and I saw myself with bruises and pain all over my body. When I leave the hospital, I come home with my family. My neighbor saw me and asked why I looked so pale and thin. I did not say anything, just walked to my house. They asked why my face looked so blue like that. So I said to them, "None of your business." These little girls are tortured, and it's something that we can't be silent about. These stories end with hope, though, and I'll take you there in just a minute. We opened Agape Restoration Center to help these victims, but if that's all we did, the problem would never go away. And we believe that God has called us to work just as equally hard on the prevention efforts. So we are equipping and mobilizing the church to take action. We do that through humanitarian aid. These people are in such abject poverty. To give a family a bag of rice will stop them from selling a girl into sexual slavery. Education. We're educating children about what really happens. We're educating adults about what really happens. Some of them out in the provinces simply don't understand that when they sell one of their daughters to work in a restaurant, that it's not a restaurant. And they have to learn what happens to them. Training and accountability. We are going simply starting at the basic things of teaching them the biblical value of women and children. This is a culture that doesn't value women and children. And so we've got to start at the very, very beginning. And church planting. This is Moses. This is the man who started AIM. And he is a wonderful man. We have over 700 churches in Cambodia that we work through. And through that effort, we've seen some wonderful things happen. The other thing that we're doing on the prevention side, do you remember the brothel in the video? This is one of them. In fact, we do believe this is one that is in that video. It sat chained and locked for 5 years, and we really thought the problem had pretty much gone away in this village. We decided that we were going to reintegrate a girl there to a family, so we did some investigation work and found out, oh no, the problem had not gone away. It was different, but these brothels were still chained and shut. So we decided we wanted to do and follow Jesus' model of going and being with these people and taking the love of Christ to them to begin to restore hope in their lives so that they could see that there are other ways. We leased this brothel. There's a picture inside of what we found. This is the pink room. Today, Rahab's house is a wonderful community center. Girls from ARC are actually going back there that were held there, and they're teaching the children crafts. They're helping them. We've actually had them do a de-lysing. They're actually ministering. When they have come and received enough healing in their own lives, they want to go back and share what they have found with the other children. We have medical clinics twice a week, free medical care to the village. These people have never even had access to the simplest of medical care. Kids Club. This is Rahab's house today, full of little children. We do this every day of the week in the afternoons, and on Sunday, we have church. That's what's going on inside this brothel now, and there are over 200 adults. That's the most we can cram in there, and the children have to stay outside. But we have had some wonderful, in these last 2 months, stories of hope. We can see how it's beginning to return. Through Rahab's house, we've had a grandmother bring her granddaughter and say, please take my daughter. We had to have some miracles occur before we could actually do that, but we got permission from the Ministry of Social Affairs as long as the village chief okayed it, which he did. This is a man who profits from the trafficking of these girls, but because of our relationship with the people in the village, he gave us permission to take this girl, and we look forward to that happening more and more and more. Also, 2 weeks ago, for the very first time in the history of this village, 50 children went to school. We're so proud that a school opened just outside the village, and we sponsor 50 children. It's $10 a month to go to school. They lined up two by two, and they marched out of their village, and their parents were cheering and yelling and screaming for them, and they started singing spontaneously worship choruses that they had learned in Rahab's house. A true, true illustration of hope. They've got hope now that there is another way. We also opened the Lord's Gym. We felt convicted. We're helping the people. We're helping the girls. God says, love your enemies. We're not doing anything to love the people who are selling these girls. So, to make a long story short, we opened a gym for them. I don't know how many of you have heard of the Radical Reality Team, and they have a Lord's Gym up near our area. Two of them came over and helped us do this, and now every day we have almost 30 young men, the people that we're targeting, they're 15 to 30 years old. They come for Bible study, and then they work out. It's really cool. This is how it looked like before we opened it. Here are some of them working out with our volunteer who oversees the SVPOC Ministries. His name's Clayton Butler. And another one. Remember Mian? Whoops. Excuse me. Well, let's hear the rest of her story. In 2006, everything changed when IJM discovered Mian in a Siem Reap brothel, and she was sent to Agape Restoration Center. Through the power of Jesus' unconditional love flowing through the ARC staff and the program, she began to have hopes and dreams for a future. At that time, my life changed from bad to good. In the past, I never had an education. Now I go to classes. I'm specializing in tailoring. It is my dream to open a tailoring shop, not a big one, but by my home, so I can make money for my family. During Mian's stay at ARC, the organization started to rent the SVPOC brothel, where Mian was first trafficked. Today, Mian and other girls from ARC volunteer at Rahab's house, teaching classes and sharing Jesus' love to dozens of children at risk. This is what Mian said about her first trip back. For my first time to Rahab's house, when the van stopped, I felt so scared to get out. But when I got out, it was good. I saw that everything had changed. Before, I was there as a sex worker. Now I go to teach children. I feel like I'm staff. I'm proud of this. Today, this is Mian at reintegration. There's a beautiful brightness in her smile. And this is what she says. I want all girls to know the way that I worked in the past. I want them to know the brothel is not a good choice. When I work there, people look down on me. I do not want this to happen to them. I will tell them, choose a good way. I thank God for my life now. Soka, the young girl who shared her story in depth with us, that's the story she shared at trial. She stood on a witness stand and told that story herself. We are so proud of her courage and her bravery. Michael Pepe, he'll never get out of jail. He was convicted on all counts as charged. He hasn't been sentenced yet, but there's no hope of him ever getting out of jail. And we're so proud of their proud of them. But Soka has not written more for us. She wants us to share her story, but she is working hard to finish high school. She's not sure what vocation she wants. She just doesn't know yet, but she is so thrilled, and she's very, very happy at ARC. One more, little Shanti. I'll finish her story. Every time Michael Pepe raped me, I feel so scared and afraid, like I live in a jail. But now I'm not thinking about this anymore. I'm studying hard. I think about my future and want to help children as I, when I get older. Today I'm 15 and live with my friends and the staff at ARC. I'm very happy. I'm not afraid or scared. I sleep good. I have at ARC a good daddy, a good house mother, good studies. I have learned I have value, dignity, and beauty. I didn't think I had this before. I have many people who love me and help me to have hope in my life. In the future, I want to be a counselor because I want to help other children. I'm afraid they will become a victim of rape and beatings like me, and I want to help my family and take my niece to school. Recently, we took all the girls at ARC on a trip to celebrate the New Year's. And when they came back, Shanti recorded a special thank you for us. And I want you to hear these words from her voice, and hear the difference that these girls can now have hope. They're laughing, they're giggling, and she's got some beautiful words of thanks.
Hello, my name is Shanti. I would like to say thank you for your kind people for my trip to Siem Reap. We have a good trip. I hope I go there again. You are my blessing. I am really thank you for your
generous.
Yes. Thank you. God bless you. Bye.
So precious. And her life is truly full of joy now. But none of it would be possible without people stepping forward to the call of Christ's heart to bring justice to the victims and the people who are oppressed, and to do it in a way that takes the most powerful weapon of all, and that is the love of Jesus Christ, and restores hope. Thank you for being here. Thank you for allowing your heart to be broken. Only in understanding these things and the heart of Christ will we really begin to make a difference.